Chris Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to Series 2, Episode 5 of Nailers Natter. This week I'm very excited to be in conversation with Tom Sherrington talking about his new book, Rosenshine's Principles in Action. Tom Sherrington has been a teacher and school leader for over 30 years, working in a wide range of school contexts around the UK and in Indonesia. And he spent 11 years as a head teacher and now is an education consultant supporting schools and colleges with teacher development, school improvement, assessment and curriculum design. He's a prolific blogger, sharing ideas via his popular website, teacherhead.com, and a strong Twitter following at teacherhead. He's a regular speaker at education conferences for teachers and school leaders, and Tom is also a trustee of the National Baccalaureate Trust. So I'm going to be speaking to Tom. I'm very excited to be speaking to him in the week where his new book, Rosenshine's Principles in Action, has been released. And just a little bit more information about this book. So as listeners will be aware, Barak Rosenshine's principles of instruction are widely recognised for their clarity and simplicity and the potential to support teachers seeking to engage with cognitive science and the wider world of pedagogic theory. So in this concise new guide, Rosenshine found Tom Sherrington amplifies and augments the principles and further demonstrates how they can be put into practice in everyday classrooms. Now, interestingly, the second half of the book also contains Rosenshine's original papers, Principles of Instruction, as published in 2010 by the International Academy of Education, and a paper that's got a superb worldwide reputation for relating research findings to classroom practice. So this book puts together Tom Sherrington's brilliant and practical commentary, and it's a powerful handbook for teachers at all levels. So without further ado, it's a fantastic, wide-ranging interview with Tom Sherrington. Okay, hello Tom and welcome to Nailers Natter.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Thank you. And thanks for doing this in the week of the release of Rosenshine's Principles in Action. And the book is absolutely flying off the shelves. Myself and Simon Cox in the Blackpool Research School are still waiting for our copy. So we had to beg, steal and borrow from Stephen Tierney. So we've had his copy. So we've had a read. And it's hit the heights of not just the education book charts, but the top 25. And I believe at points it's been outselling Michelle Obama and even the Wonky Donkey as well.
Even the Wonky Donkey. Yeah, I still don't know how many copies it is. But it beggars belief to me. It's like a book about teaching is up there with Jamie Oliver's recipes and stuff like that. It's crazy. So it's for comparison, my last book, I think it was once in the top 1,000 for about a day, and then never up since. So to be up to it means a lot of people are buying it. So I think I've hit the sweet spot with people wanting to read about Rosenshine.
Absolutely. So that leads me into the first question, really. So why are Barak Rosenshine's principles of instruction so good, do you think?
Well, I think it's because they are based around observing what effective teachers typically do. So people recognise them as being things which are sensible. And it's not a surprise. Sometimes people say, oh, this is nothing new, as if that's a kind of dismissal. But of course it isn't. So, you know, the paper originates from the 70s, really, and then publications in the 80s. It's these ideas about effective teachers have been around for a long time. So they resonate. People read them and go, yeah, I get that. Questioning, checking for understanding, it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason. But also because they are evidence-based. They aren't just Rosenshine writing a paper saying, you know what, I reckon these are things which ought to make teachers good. He's actually looked at what teachers do. And linked to them with the cognitive science. So it's all underpinned by another set of research about how, you know, memory works and so on. And the two sets of ideas overlap. And it's in the overlap of observational research and kind of experimental research, which you find these sort of common threads. And that's why they work. You know, there's a real strong interface there. And I think that's why people like them.
Definitely. And that resonated with me in terms of this podcast. So the reason I started this is to try and make sort of research accessible for teachers. you know, through sort of taking ideas off the page, as you put it in the book, and actually putting them into action. So to what extent do you think that Rose and Shine kind of bridges that research practice divide?
Well, I think it's probably the best example there is of somebody communicating ideas really well for teachers. I think it's alongside something like Graham Nuttall's Hidden Lives of Learners, which has got a lot of similar ideas. You know, where they, 1 minute they're talking about schema and short-term memory, and the next minute they're talking about how you walk around the classroom to ask questions, you know, the actual practicalities. So I think that it's very effective. He has this sort of neat rhythm of saying, the research says this, in the classroom, this is what it looks like, and you know, more effective teachers typically do these things. And that kind of flow repeatedly throughout the paper makes you think, yeah, I get this. I understand this. Of course, you have to trust what he's saying about the papers. I mean, you might have to then go to all the citations and check out the validity of all those studies. But teachers don't have time for that. So at some level, trust is important. You've got to think, and because he seems like he's been in a lot of lessons and observed real teachers, you think, oh, you know, I trust the guy. He makes sense. And that's really important.
Definitely. And you mentioned that the principles of instruction are supported by sort of learning models from cognitive science. Could you go into a little bit more detail? I know you do this in the book, about, you know, which particular areas are kind of supported there.
Well, so for example, the importance of retrieval practice for developing, you know, fluency, you know, retrieving from long-term memory and repeated practice of skills to the point where they kind of become more confident with them. That's a strongly evidenced part of things like cognitive load theory, or, you know, a lot of cognitive science around recall, desirable difficulties, also those sorts of things. So he just builds it into his, you know, daily review, weekly and monthly review, the idea that you've got to practice things, and also guided practice, the idea that early on you need to be getting things correct, otherwise you're practicing kind of making errors. And that's strongly evidenced in the cognitive load theory as well. Kind of the novice to expert journey isn't something you can just sort of cut a corner on. You do need to do different things when you're a novice, and then as you get more expert. And he says in the paper, you know, the more sophisticated the learners are, the older they are, the more confident they are, the more quickly they can go to the independent practice phase. So it's definitely, and that's you know, echoes the novice to expert ideas that come out of cognitive science.
Definitely. Anyway, I mean, you mentioned in the book about some other kind of key pieces and key books there. So you mentioned Willingham before about Why Don't Students Like School, and you also mentioned Nuttall, which obviously, you know, in the research school we've read, but might not, other listeners may not be as much aware of that one, The Hidden Lives of Learners. But these things, that, you know, we're starting to see the sort of the join up with all of these different papers. And we had Daniel Mears on last week talking about, you know, Kirshner, Sweller and Clark and other people, about all these ideas seem to be feeding into this. But as you mentioned at the beginning, it seems to be really popular, Rosenshine, because it makes it very practical to be used in the classroom.
Exactly, yeah. So he gives examples of, say, you know, question stems and you know, different classroom scenarios. And he also, this thing is sort of counterexample. So by constantly seeing what less effective teachers do, it helps you understand what he means. So there are degrees. So, you know, for example, the metacognitive aspect of questioning, where you're sort of saying, how do we know? How do we work it out? How do we problem solve? Rather than, you know, what do we know? And he talks about that in the phrase process questions. So, you know, he says more effective teachers ask lots of questions, but also process questions, where they, you know, how did you know? How did you work that out? Whereas less effective teachers hardly ask any, if at all. They don't ask any process questions. And that's an observational thing. So I think that's, you know, it's very tangible. You can say to a teacher, you know, do you ask process questions? Do you say, is it a routine? Do you do it as a default? And I think that makes it super practical. Whereas when you're reading about metacognition, it can seem ludicrously abstract. Like, what is it about? You know, it feels like a sort of a something which is out there that you can't quite touch it.
Well, it absolutely does. I mean, just to go off on a slight tangent on that, the number of times that we're asked to come and deliver a 20-minute one-hit on what is metacognition, and you just think, well, you can't possibly get even to scratch the surface of the kind of things they're talking about there in a 20-minute one-hit. I mean, yes, you can give a flavour, but you can't possibly scratch the surface of it. So that's very interesting.
No, and I think Well, it does through the practice. I mean, there'll be lots of great teachers who've probably done that instinctively for, you know, for their whole life without ever thinking, oh, this is called metacognition.
Yeah.
And that's the point, you know, that when you've learnt the way to be effective through years of experience and trial and error, maybe these are the things that you end up doing. And that's what research is hopefully helping students, like, get there quicker. You know, we don't have to spend 10 years guessing and then kind of work out what seems to be working. You can just say, look, let's train teachers around this stuff, get students thinking about how they approach a problem in a metacognitive way rather than just knowing the answer. And if that becomes how teachers think continually, changing their own habits so that's something they do day in, day out, then it's all good.
Absolutely. Right, well, let's drill down a little bit more into that in terms of what it looks like in the classroom. So strand one, and you've organised the principles into strands in the book. Strand one looks at sequencing, concepts and modelling. So what relevant instructional procedures could teachers use there?
Well, the first bit of that is preparation. It's thinking about your curriculum, breaking it down into small steps. I think that's vital. You don't just sort of go in the classroom and wing it, but you... So that's a kind of preparation stage. Have I got the small steps kind of mapped out in my mind? Do I know how you build, say, a sequence of questions in algebra or writing, where introducing the next element, or, you know, grammar in languages, knowing the right time to add the next sort of development in their understanding of grammar? Those things need to be done in advance. So they're not like, this isn't a tricks and tips type situation. This is like deep analysis of your curriculum. And it's probably the hardest step of all, in a way, because if you are busking it in the classroom, you're probably not going to do it very well. So I think that's the first thing to say.
Just on that, Tom, I'm really sorry to interrupt there. So in terms of that, what role do you think a knowledge-rich curriculum would play in the implementation of these principles?
Well, look, this is an important point to stress. I kind of copy this in the book. That Rosenstein says, he doesn't say it in the principles, but he says it in an earlier version, that the principles of instruction reply most strongly where you have a kind of highly structured curriculum, and all subjects have highly structured elements. And basically, in other words, lots of specific knowledge elements. So he's not saying it's a universal for all modes of teaching or all subjects either. And that's super important. You know, there are other types of things you do in teaching where it's not instructional, or where the knowledge base is less. It's formal, where it doesn't apply as well. So that's important. So where you do have a strong knowledge base, then the principle of instruction are a really good way of delivering that, so the students learn it, and that's the way it goes. Where a knowledge rich curriculum, which is defined in terms of like being precise about what everyone should know, these are the things everyone should learn. Then it definitely helps, because then you can check whether the students have learnt it. I think that's the way it goes. You know, it's hard to check for understanding if you're not clear about what the understanding is. And if you haven't thought about what a good answer would look like at the depth you're expecting at a high standard, then it's harder to sort of reference that back and probe the students to go deeper. And I see that quite often with teachers who are sort of just happy to get anything. You know, they get, oh, great, someone answered. Woo, you know, they're not focusing on a goal, a knowledge goal as per se. And that, so the kind of, it feels more sort of, the standards are lower. Whereas if someone is like saying that, come on, this is the kind of pitch we're after, let's get there, let's really push for it, because they've specified it and they're really clear about the standard, then I think it works. So yeah, I mean, that's the first bit. And then the next bit of that is the modelling. So modelling is huge. It's one of those things which, again, I think is really high status in teaching. Showing people, it's one of the most obvious parts of teaching, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let me show you how to do something. Let me show you how to do this. Let me show you how to do that. Right, now can you do it? It's the most instinctive thing you have when you try to explain something to somebody. Let me show you. And it's so key, modelling, showing, explaining. And multiple examples comes into that, you know, showing them not just one time, but several times, in different ways maybe, and students getting a real clear idea of what it is they're trying to learn. So the modelling is important. Breaking it down to small steps of modelling. And then when it's difficult, it's showing how you reach the high standard, the kind of scaffolding aspect. Is Rosenstein's really, really good on that, that you then, you say, well, all right, to be able to construct this type of argument or this type of language structure, here's the scaffolding to get there. and you know, piece by piece. So right now, can you do it by yourself? You pull the scaffolding away later and see if students can do the whole thing on their own. But if they can't do the whole thing on their own, you have to scaffold it. You have to say, we'll just do step one, step two, and then I'll help you with the third bit or whatever. So knowing what all those things look like in English, in art, in year three writing, you know, it's that's the teacher's prep, really. It's getting ready to be able to teach. It means I need to know what these steps look like, and I need to know what good curriculum level scaffolds look like.
Definitely, definitely. Moving on to strand two, if that's okay. So in terms of questioning, so I was interested with a little bit of crossover here because we use quite a lot of Teach Like a Champion. So I still run sort of initial teacher training, NQTs, that kind of thing. So we've gone quite heavy on Duglimov's Teach Like a Champion. So I saw that some of the techniques that he uses, you kind of tied in with questioning strategies that you found useful for teachers. So could you talk a little bit more about what kind of things you've found useful in terms of questioning?
Yeah, when I found over the time I've been training teachers and just been performing my own practice, I've gleaned ideas from different places about what really cuts through, what's a good strategy. And Teach Like a Champion has got lots of techniques in it. Mm. And there are lots of sort of names for types of question strategy, which have got sort of jazzy names to them. But I find cold calling the most sort of useful and powerful technique that student teachers all ought to have. And where they don't cold call, I often see that as where students fall through the gaps. And essentially, and because Duglimov calls this thing cold calling, it's a good word. I mean, you could call it something else, but he's defined it in his book. So I just think, you know, for me, if people have a good understanding of what cold calling means, which essentially means asking a question to the class, giving them time to think, and then selecting who you get to respond. Mm. And very deliberately making sure everybody thinks it could be them that needs to answer, because they're thinking about the answer before someone is chosen. And that to me is a really powerful strategy. And you know what? I don't think, generally speaking, it's nearly close to being as ubiquitous as it should be. You've still got a lot of teachers throwing a question out into the room and then checking whoever fancies the answer. That is the default, or, you know, with a hand up. And it's a shifted attitude to think, why doesn't that work? It's because if one student answers, you have no idea what anyone else thinks, and the person who volunteers an answer may already have known it already, and didn't really learn it from you, and it doesn't tell you enough as a teacher about how well you've explained things. So anyway, there's loads of reasons why cold calling is important. And the second one from Teach Like a Champion is no opt-out, which is a kind of way of dealing with the kind of, you know, I don't know, the shrug off, I don't know, or dealing with kids who just panic and go, I don't know, and think, you know, you need to know straight away, and it gives those kids a way back into the lesson without feeling demoralised if you get them to build confidence having initially not known. So that's that strategy. So there are two really good ones from Teach Like a Champion, which I just think, well, why keep inventing new words for things? Just use the same terms.
I mean, a good passage that, if you don't mind me reading your own book back to you, but I particularly like the bit about, you know, a strong message from Rose and Shine is that more effective teachers ask more questions, but then, as you said, clarify and check for understanding. So do you see that's where something like no opt-out comes in, because you're having to rely on asking everybody to make sure, and cold calling, you have to ask everybody and then check. And if they don't understand, they need to make sure that they're listening to somebody else's explanation so they can re-put that back to the teacher.
Yeah, and also, you know, checking for understanding is just even for even if everyone's paying full attention, full on, and, you know, checking for understanding, it could just be that there's five of us in the room or around a table or 25 of us in the room. What do you think? What do you understand by this concept? What do you understand by this process? What do you understand by the motivation of this character in the story? And, you know, does it resonate with what I think I've explained to you? I think I've explained it. Did you understand what I said? Getting a reflection back. And gosh, you know, you nearly every single time you ever do that, you get different answers from, you know, the person one, person two, person three, because they've interpreted the information differently. And that's rich territory for probing the knowledge at hand and also telling you how well things are going in terms of the early stages of learning. And again, you know, these things are put in there because they are things which I think more teachers need to do more of. It's just it's pretty rare, I find, to go into a lesson and find a teacher really consciously just making sure, like, you know, individuals have understood. And then you have this sort of the old, and Rosenshine uses it himself, doesn't he? He says, you know, how not to check for understanding is to say things like, have you all understood? has everyone understood? Yeah, good, great. You know,
a question usually asked directly before break or lunch, which makes it double effective, you know.
Definitely. I actually did a training thing, an activity thing last week as an adult with a group of other adults, and you know, the instructor was saying, okay, guys, all good, thumbs up. That's how he was questioning. We didn't even have a chance to answer it. It was just that it's just a weird thing, you know, even if we were already totally unsure about what we were about to do, we would have had no opportunity to sort of voice it, because he wasn't saying, right, let's hear one of you repeat it back. What's the process? What do we do next? He didn't. That wasn't the way. So anyway, that checking for understanding is probably the core of Rosenshine's principles, if you ask me.
Obviously, there are many, many great things about this book, but also they are backed up with high-quality visuals, if that's the right word, from Oliver Caviglioli, and one for this on questioning, where you've got message sent and then message received, kind of sums that up a little bit in terms of the illustrations that you've got alongside the text.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of the ones where, I mean, I had these really, I've had these slides on this Rosenshine for a while, and I'd made up some really dodgy version of that. So I sent it to Oliver, and he made it look really slick. So I was quite happy with that. Yeah. He's good for that. I mean, some of the illustrations that he designs and even some of them are my back of an envelope that he's turned into something professional looking.
Well, that one's really, really effective. If we can move on to sort of effective and sustainable routines. So in terms of daily, weekly, monthly review, how can teachers go about making that part of their everyday practice?
There are so many ways. So it's about having a repertoire of things that you do. So it's about, but the main thing you need to do all the time is set up a set of knowledge that the students are going to be tested on later. So you say, they should know that, I think, it's so they can actively learn it rather than just it sort of being happening at randomly. I think that's one of the important things, is to be saying to students at the end of a discussion or a lesson or a set of learning, right, guys, so these are the things you should know, and we're going to be coming back to these in our little quizzes or whatever. So make sure you're rehearsing the knowledge and teaching them the ways of checking themselves. So you've got to talk explicitly to the students about the fact that they're going to forget unless they practice. But then you do, you know, a set of, I'm really conscious of what you should do every lesson, because that's nonsense. There are a range of things that you need to vary. There's the variation that is part of the process, because the students need to encounter the information in different ways. So you could just do a quick quiz, you know, 10 questions, or you could give them a quiz where it's on paper and they check it, or it could be telling the story, you know, run through with the person next to you, explain the answer to that thing that we discussed last week. So they have to actually rehearse the knowledge again. You don't just say, does everyone remember what we did last lesson? Yeah. And everyone go, yeah, you know, that's no good. You say, okay, in your pair, using pairs, talk through and see if you can re-explain that scenario. Or you do a simple factual recall test, or there's so many different things, or filling, you know, just a brain dump, you know, like a kind of mind map. Draw a kind of mind map for the evolution of you know, that idea that we developed last year and last month in geography or science or whatever. But then check it with something. They have to have a verification process. That's an important thing. Mm-hmm. You need to say, right, well, did you get it all? This is what I got. Did you get all of what I got? Did you get it right? Did you get your answers right? Did you know the meaning of the words? So that's important. So I say there are three stages. You clarify the knowledge the student's supposed to have. You give all manner of ways of then checking their own knowledge. And then the third step is you get them to check whether they are right. And then that's got to be part of something you work into a quick routine, for depending on which type of test that you or checking process that you're using.
Definitely.
Gosh, it's hard to condense that into a few minutes.
No, I'm just going to say that what you have done, I mean, we've done quite a lot of training around presenting Rosenshine's principles of instruction as a paper, and we've done this quite a lot to sort of mixed groups and certainly within our own school, but what you've done with this book, and this is what I really like about it, in terms of the practice, you've given real concrete examples across many different subjects. So you've got things like fronted adverbials, number bonds, French lessons. So there's loads and loads of concrete examples for listeners out there, whatever subject or discipline it is that you're teaching, to actually look at how do you go about embedding the stages of practice within your practice, if you like.
Yeah, and that's come about from, I mean, the original reason I wrote this book is because I did a talk about a research ed event, and somebody watched it and said that, why don't you make a, you know, that'd be really good if you made this into a book. And those talks, you know, and also when I go to do CPD in schools, often I'm doing it at a through school, like a, with, you know, reception up to year 13. And they say it's all ages and all subjects. Is that okay? Oh, gosh. So I've had to work up a number of different things that kind of different people will relate to. Otherwise, they don't think that you're talking to them. So, I mean, there's loads of stuff in writing and early stages of maths for primary teachers, and aspects of knowledge, science and geography, which is universal. So, hopefully that's been useful. I think one of the main things I'm also trying to think about is workload. So in a little section there about retrieval practice strategies, you know, checking for understanding, daily review, weekly, monthly review, is to make all those things zero marking. The students need to check their own work. Mm. And if you've set up a kind of monthly review where that's ended up with you taking all these papers home to mark, I think, no, that's not necessary. It's the students who need to know if they've got it right, not you. You know, that's the big emphasis. Am I right? Do I know it? That's what you should be engendering in your students, checking themselves that they know things, not, and then flushing out kind of areas of doubt, misconceptions, that kind of thing. But the idea that the teacher has to verify all the students' answers is an impossible thing to get enough feedback to the students. So this is where the kind of engineering things that the students can check each other's or check their own is the main thing to develop. You get much higher frequency of that going on then.
Definitely.
It amplifies the kind of number of times that they can check the knowledge. Mm. And then, of course, then you fly in and do your own checking, you know, in a more formal way here and there. But the day-in, day-out diet has got to be all about students checking their own.
Absolutely. So just in conclusion, Tom, I know that that many schools, and certainly schools in Blackpool that we're working with, have bought this book for all their staff. And you know, I would personally recommend that. That's what they have done. And I would recommend this for many of the reasons that I've said so far. So how can schools, do you think, use this book to support maybe professional development?
Well, first of all, I think you need to have a kind of... recognize that different teachers will. I think the first thing is to make sure everyone understands certain things. So have sessions where you say, do we all know what we're talking about? We say daily review, where we say cold calling, where we say check it for understanding. So let's agree the terms, let's discuss that. And then you say, you agree a kind of focus for maybe individuals or a team to go off for a period where they practice doing something in their session, in their lesson, in a quite a focused way. So let me really try and improve this, and then report back to the next session and say, look, how's it going? And it could have, you know, there could be feedback opportunities in between that. But that's how it would influence CPD, where it gives people a common language for certain strategies at the beginning where they discuss it together. But then they individually go off and practice aspects. And they have, you have to have this sort of cycle, don't you, of coming back to things. Yeah. Or else it kind of... It's extraordinary to me how a group of adults can leave a room having a totally different idea about something which you all thought you were saying the same thing about at the time. And this is where coming back, that's why it's useful to base it on this common document, because you can say, come on, do we all understand what this means? And when we say cold calling, this is what we mean, not that other thing, this version. Let's practice that. And then maybe pairs or triads are brilliant for this, where they're quite a nimble little team of people can check it, talk to each other, visit each other. And then that's probably the most useful thing I find. Bigger groups than three, you end up with, you know, diverging thinking, and it's less nimble to organise the gatherings. But sort of pairs and triads of teachers, and then coming together maybe larger subject groups to report back how they've been getting on, that type of thing. So this needs to feed into a bigger pattern of CPD in a school, not lots of one-off events, I'd say.
And it's very interesting that you said about raising sort of awareness of this particular paper through your book, but also we're finding that now that the education inspection framework is live and the research commentary that goes alongside that, we are being approached quite a lot more to ask us, you know, what is cognitive load theory, or what is retrieval practice, or what are all these kind of things. So this is a really important book in raising people's sort of research literacy in a very practical way that you can take and use within your classroom, first of all, but like you said, with other colleagues within faculties, whatever it is, and wider across the school.
Yeah, well, I'm really pleased about that. In fact, I was pretty chuffed the other last week, I think it was, when Teacher Tap did a question where they said, you know, who's heard of the Barrett-Rosenshine's principles of instruction, and then how many of you actually know what they are. So there's about 50% recognition of it, which meant literally, I think it was 50% had never heard of them at all, and about 3,500 respondents. And then of the 50%, there's like 30% of people knew what they said. So there's another 20% of people who had heard of it but had no idea what the principles were. So that's really amazing. That's like 70% of all those people didn't know what Rosenshine's principles were. So there's still like a load of people out there who are just not even engaged with it at all. Mm. And that's even assuming that the 30% are kind of like really kind of up, really knowing it well. So there's a long way to go, but it is only one paper as well. So I imagine, you know, you scale that up to various other things. But if you are going to pick one, I mean, that's why I've written about it and done all these talks on it, because if you aren't going to pick one, I'd say it's the one, because it's the best place to start, given what there is. And then people can spin off, and there's so many other things to read. Like I reference the Marge paper from Shimomura in there, because I'd love that as well.
Yeah.
I think that's the next one to write a book about a book, because it's really cool. I think there's so much in it.
Well, definitely, we'll look forward to that. Is that an exclusive, Tom, for the podcast?
Well, I've only slowed that up now, so I just had that idea right now. Seeing how there's an appetite for people writing short books about short papers, I'm thinking this could be the way to go.
Definitely, you heard it there first, an exclusive. So, this section of the podcast, we normally talk about what you've got coming up next and where people can see you either speaking or presenting, or, you know, and we've already talked about what your next book's going to be. So we read with interest that you're going to be doing a curriculum thinking masterclass with two of our favourites, with John Thompson and Mary Myatt. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about what that's going to entail?
Yeah, so Mary, John and I are doing a talk each. Mary and I discussed this idea that sometimes when we do these talks at a conference, at a festival, you only get like 40 minutes and then everyone leaves, and we wanted a chance to do a longer talk with more questions at the end, to make it more interactive. And John was really keen to do it as well. So the three of us got together and put this idea together. And the London one is sold out in June, but in October, we've got events in Birmingham, Manchester, Cardiff, as well as another one in London. And there's still loads of tickets left for those ones. But the idea is that each of us has a kind of slightly different take on what a great curriculum process is, you know, curriculum thinking is. So I'm going to let, you know, John's very much grounded in his experience in a school. Mine is grounded in kind of helping other schools to go through a process of review. And Mary's is just lots of really fundamental ideas about what different concepts in curriculum thinking that people really kind of should have in their mind when they're planning the curriculum. So there's like a different take. So that I think it'll be, there's opportunities for people to come and talk to us about what we're thinking, and hopefully it'll help them with their thinking.
Brilliant, brilliant. And we'll put links to that on the podcast intro. Now, this is the I'm going to put you on the spot question. And I think you probably know what I'm going to ask you now in terms of the reason this podcast started, both to try and improve research literacy amongst teachers, but also it was kind of a vehicle to showcase the people that were talking at Research Ed Blackpool last year. Now, I know that obviously you did Research Ed Blackpool the year before, and then you like to leave 1 year fallow. So I'm going to ask you the question now, whether we can pin you down for Blackpool Research Ed 2020.
You know, I'm going to be really terrible and say I'm going to have to look at my diary, because I actually don't even know when it is. I would really love to do it, because it's actually one of my favourite events that I've done. It was a lot, the big hall, and I was talking about assessment at that event. Mm. It's a fantastic event. So I'm going to say in principle I would love to come, but I just need to make sure that it fits in with weekends, you know, because you know, I need to do the garden and stuff.
So it's gardening or research at Blackpool. Let's see what we
can do. Weekends are the weekends, and you can only work so many Saturdays. So, and I do about like 20 Saturdays a year, which is a lot. So, but yeah, I want to come. So you'll have to force me. I'm really going to try to avoid saying 100% now, because otherwise that would be difficult. But I will tell you really soon whether that's. You need to confirm the date for me, and then I'll check it out.
Absolutely. Well, we'll take a yes in principle, and we'll take the fact that you've enjoyed it. So that's absolutely fantastic.
Oh God, yeah, it was really, really good.
Great stuff. Right, Tom, thank you very much for your time, particularly in this really, really busy week. Thanks for speaking to us today. And I'll put all the links to the book, to the talks, to all the papers, and some of the other ones that you talked about there for listeners to get involved with. So thanks again for giving up your time this afternoon.
No, thank you. It's been really good talking to you. I've enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Cheers then. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Everyone, you are listening to my dad on the podcast called Naylor's Natter.
Follow him on Twitter at PNA1977.
Wow, what a fantastic interview there with Tom. And thanks again, Tom, for giving up your time to speak to me on Naylor's Natter. If you're one of the few who hasn't yet bought the book, then to misquote Doug Lamov, do now. And there are links to all the ways that you can do this on the podcast intro. Now for the shameless plugs coming up soon section. So on the 6th of June, I'll be hosting a launch event for the EEF's Behaviour Report at the Hollins in Accrington. And this is for the East Lancashire Teaching School Alliance in conjunction with the Blackpool Research School. Loads and loads of interest in this, so sign up now before there are no tickets left. And there's links on the podcast intro there. On the 15th of June, I will be speaking at Research Ed Rugby on escaping the hamster wheel, using research and CPD to change culture in schools. And on the 20th and 21st of June, myself and Simon Cox will be at the Festival of Education. Very excited that next week on the podcast we have Mark Enser speaking to about his book, Making Every Geography Lesson Count, and his work as a research lead and as a prolific writer for TES. So thank you again to Tom. Thank you again for your company. See you again soon.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.